We are in chapter 13. We dealt with the parable of the sower yesterday, and then we hop back into verse 10 after going through those 23 verses. Yes?
I was wondering why the parable of the sower is not among these.
Is not among what? What is these? Oh, why I have this on the board like this?
Without the
parable. The parable of the sower is kind of an introductory concept to the kingdom. This is the way people receive the kingdom message. And this is describing the kingdom message. These next six describe kind of the kingdom concept, the nature of the kingdom, the victory of the kingdom. Even though this is victory, the parable of the weeds and the wheats describes a lot of what the kingdom is about, what we'll get to today, where it's not a kingdom the way the Jews saw it, as the good coming in and eradicating all the evil. The good and the evil are actually coexisting each other. And even though in the face of evil, the good will triumph. So this is going to be describing the kingdom in more detail. But the parable of the sower is initially introducing all seven of them by saying, this is the way in which people receive the message. Here is the message. Does that make sense?
Good question.
Parable of the sower we dealt with yesterday, and then we jump back to verse 10. So that's where we're going to start right now. Get moving. The disciples came to him and asked, "Why do you speak to the people in parables?" He replied, "The knowledge of the secrets of the kingdom of heaven has been given to you, but not to them." What did we define the secret of the kingdom of heaven yesterday? What's that? What is being established? Not that the kingdom is being established, because that's pretty been broadcasted to everybody at this point, that the kingdom has come. But what kingdom has come? That is the secrets that's been revealed to the disciples. Although, don't picture it like this. Don't picture it like telephone, where you're having to go like this to somebody's ear and whisper it to them and hoping they get in the right message as they pass it down. That's not the way that you picture this secret being passed on. The secret or the mystery of the kingdom has been revealed to everyone, but the disciples are clearly the ones that get it, even though everybody has been on witness of it. And that's where we're going to be getting here in a minute, of the talk of, they have eyes to see, but they're not seeing. They have ears to hear, but they're not hearing. Let's keep reading. "Whoever has will be given more, and he will have an abundance. Whoever does not have, even what he has will be taken from him." That'll become a principle we'll talk about later. But in this context, what he's saying is, if they get it, they're going to get it even more. If they don't get it, it's going to confuse them even more. Verse 13. "This is why I speak to them in parables." Here's the answer to their question. "This is why I speak to them in parables. Though seeing, they do not see. Though hearing, they do not hear or understand." Remember the concept of secret that we talked about yesterday in verse, 11? Is in the context of covenant language in Deuteronomy 29:29. Covenant language, where Deuteronomy 29:29 says, "The secret things belong to the Lord our God, but the things revealed belong to us and to our children forever, that we may follow all the words of this law." And Deuteronomy 29:29 comes at the end of a chapter outlining, describing the covenant that God is making with Israel. So the secret's language is already in covenant. And I'm going to suggest that he's not stopping the covenant conversation. That with the passage here referred to, and I say passage because in verse 13 we have parallels in Jeremiah 5 and Ezekiel 12, but we don't have a one-to-one correlation as far as this verse is concerned. But those seeing, they do not see. Though hearing, they do not hear or understand. We're still talking in covenant language. Let me read you the definition of this concept. Whenever you see this, think rebellion against covenant. Anytime you see the language, like in Revelation, you'll see, "He who has ears to hear, let him hear." That's covenant language. It's covenant language that's calling people to obedience, not to cognitive understanding, but to obedience. Ezekiel chapter 12, verses 1 through 2, defines these eyes that cannot see, these ears that cannot hear concept, this language. It says, "The word of the Lord came to me. Son of man, you are living among a rebellious people. They have eyes to see, but do not see, and ears to hear, but do not hear, for they are a rebellious people." What is eyes seeing that, or eyes that do not see and ears that do not hear? What is that language? What is it talking about? Who is it describing? It's not just describing idiotic people. It's not just describing people that are just, they just don't get it. They're just not smart enough to understand what Jesus is saying. It's not what it's describing. What it's describing is people that are rebellious. So says Ezekiel 12. Rebellious people. They see what's happening. They're hearing the message. They get what Jesus is saying. But they refuse. They refuse to obey. That's the same thing that happens in Jeremiah 5, 20 through 25. Says, announce this to the house of Jacob and proclaim it to Judah. Hear this, you foolish and senseless people who have eyes but do not see, who have ears but do not hear. Should you not fear me, declares the Lord? Should you not tremble in my presence? I made the sand a boundary for the sea, an everlasting barrier it cannot cross. The waves may roll, but they cannot prevail. They may roar, but they cannot cross it. But these people have stubborn and rebellious hearts. They have turned aside and gone away. They did not say to themselves, let us fear the Lord our God, who gives autumn and spring rains in season, who assures us of the regular weeks of harvest. Your wrongdoings have kept these away. Your sins have deprived you of any good. So whenever Jesus says, the reason why I speak to them in parables is because why? Why? Answer this for me. Based on these two Old Testament passages, why does he speak to them in parables? Because they're rebellious. It's not like these people are hearing the message for the very first time. It's not like they haven't seen the miraculous deeds that he's doing. They have seen and they have heard, but they refuse to obey. And that's why he's now switched. He's saying, you know what? Parables is going to be my modus operandi. Why? Because they're rebellious. And the people that are good soil, when they hear the parables, they will even be given more understanding. But whenever I'm talking to people that are rebellious, they will move even further into their rebellion. Because it's not like the message hasn't been plain and clear to them. It's not like that they've just, you know, Jesus is the very first time talking to them and just starts throwing out parables. It's not the issue. The issue is this is a rebellious people that refuses to hear what they are hearing, that refuses to see what they are seeing. Yeah?
In my induction study, I read the Isaiah 6 chapter 2, and further on in that chapter, God says he doesn't tell them plainly because he doesn't want them to hear with their ears. He wants them to hear with their hearts.
Yeah. Matter of fact, I'm glad you brought up Isaiah 6 because that's the very next passage that we deal with in verse 14 and following. In them is fulfilled the prophecy of Isaiah. You will be ever hearing, but never understanding. You will be ever seeing, but never perceiving. For this people's heart has become calloused, their hard soil. They hardly hear with their ears, and they have closed their eyes. Otherwise, they might see with their eyes, hear with their ears, understand with their hearts, and turn, and I would heal them. He's not saying I'm playing this cosmic game where it's like for some people I'm whispering the truth and the other people I'm like, haha, you have to figure it out. That's not what's happening here. He's saying these people are hearing and seeing very clearly, but they refuse to hear and see. I want them to understand. If they would understand with their hearts, I would allow them to turn and I would heal them of their blindness. But they don't want to hear. They don't want to see. Matter of fact, let's talk about the trajectory of Isaiah. That comes from Isaiah 6, 9 through 10, that passage right there. Isaiah 6, 9 through 10, good test question. This is the pronouncement of judgment for the people of Israel because their rebellion has been lamented all through Isaiah 5. So Isaiah 5, he's lamenting the rebellion. Isaiah 6, this is the pronouncement of the judgment in a sense. But then right after Isaiah 6, 9 through 10, the passage that was just quoted here, Isaiah asks this in Isaiah 6, 11. He says, then Isaiah says, how long, O Lord? And the question that he's asking is, how long will they be in their rebellion? How long will they be in exile from the truth? How long will they be blind and deaf? And the answer comes in Isaiah 6:13 through 7:14. What is significant about Isaiah 7:14? Oh, you know that passage, don't you? Remember? Yes. Exactly. But then there will be a virgin, and she will give birth to a child, and his name will be called Emmanuel, which means God with us. How long? Whenever the Anointed One comes. As a matter of fact, this what we're running through in chapter 6 climaxes in chapter 9 of Isaiah. It says, "The people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of the shadow of death, a light has dawned." Whenever light comes to darkness, what happens? You move from blindness to being able to see. It goes on, it says, "For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders." "And he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace there will be no end. He will reign on David's throne and over his kingdom, establishing and upholding it with justice and righteousness from that time on and forever. The zeal of the Lord Almighty will accomplish this." When Jesus points to the Isaiah 6 chapter to describe the rebelliousness of this people, he is also pointing to himself. He's saying the answer's come. There is no reason for them to be blind and deaf still, except for the hardness of their hearts. So, this is why I speak in parables. Because they know what I've said, they've seen the power I've brought, and they refuse to obey. Verse 16, "But blessed are you, blessed are your eyes because they see, and your ears because they hear. For I tell you the truth, many prophets and righteous men longed to see what you see, but did not see it, and to hear what you hear, but did not hear it." What are they longing to hear and see? What are they longing to hear and see, the prophets of the old? The Messiah and the coming of the kingdom. Exactly. This is the this is what, matter of fact, you can hear Isaiah probably crying out from the grave saying, "Finally, the government will be on his shoulders. The Wonderful Counselor has come." This is what they were looking forward to. This is the hope of the nation of Israel. And some people, even though they're seeing it and even though they're hearing it, are refusing to obey it. Okay, let's jump now to the parable of the weeds in verse 24. Okay, really quick, let me go over this. These six parables, I'm going to structure them like this. You start off with victory, with the parable of the weed and the wheats. It moves then to the program, or the way in which the kingdom will progress. And that's the parable of the mustard seed, which is reiterated in the parable of the yeast. Then we move, after we do another little purpose of parables, which is important for us to remember why they're still functioning, we move into the victory again. See, notice, victory is the beginning, middle, and end of all this. Because this is going to explain the weed and the weeds, or the weeds and the wheat. Then we move into the worth, two worth parables, the parable of the hidden treasure, parable of the hidden pearl, which is both of these are predicated off of the victory and the way in which it moves. Because of these two things, this is true. And ultimately, we end with the parable of the nets, which again reiterates victory. Because in the following chapters, we're going to be dealt with a lot of conflict. We're going to be dealing with, the conflict is going to be escalating. From chapters, matter of fact, chapter 14 comes on the scene, and what's the first conflict we see? John the Baptist's death. Even in the face of evil, the kingdom of God will be victorious. It may look unbecoming. It may look like it's not doing much. But I'm telling you, there is victory in this. And because of this victory, it is to be treasured more than anything. Because ultimately, in the face of evil, victory will prevail. The kingdom of God will prevail. That's the message of these six. So let's unpack them. Okay. Chapter 13, verse 24. Jesus told them another parable. "The kingdom of heaven is like..." That phrase introduces all six of these parables. Matthew 13, 24, which is what I just read. 13, 31. 13, 33. 13, 44. 13, 45. 13, 47. Let me say it a second time. 13, 24. 13:31, 13:33, 13:44, 13:45, and 13:47. Every single one of the parables is introduced by saying, "The kingdom of heaven is like." The kingdom of heaven is like. This is why the third discourse a lot of times is called the kingdom parables. But if you have the kingdom lens on for the first 13 chapters, you understand why he's at this point. This is, the kingdom is like what? "It is like a man who sowed good seed in his field, but while everyone was sleeping, his enemy came and sowed weeds among the wheat and went away. When the wheat sprouted and formed heads, then the weeds also appeared. The owner's servants came to him and said, 'Sir, didn't you sow good seed in your field? Where then did the weeds come from?' 'An enemy did this,' he replied. The servants asked him, "Do you want us to go and pull them up, pull up the weeds?" Weeds, if you're like pluralizing one and not the other, kind of mess with your head. Okay. "No," he answered, "because while you're pulling the weeds, you may root up the wheat with them. Let them both grow together until the harvest. At that time, I will tell the harvesters, 'First, collect the weeds and tie them in bundles to be burned. Then gather the wheat and bring it into my barn.'" Okay, let's jump down to verse 36, because Jesus awesomely once again interprets this parable for us. Verse 36. "Then he left the crowd and went into the house. His disciples came to him and said, 'Explain to us the parable of the weeds of the field.' He answered, 'The one who sowed the good seed is the Son of Man.'" Okay? So let's start pulling these out. This first, in verses 37 and 38, we are going to have the definition of three key elements that are introduced in verse 24. Okay? So in verses 37 and 38, he's going to define for us the three key elements of verse 24. The first key element is the sower. The sower in verse 24 is identified as the Son of Man in verse 37. And what is Son of Man language referring to? What passage of the Old Testament? Daniel chapter 7, verses 13 through 14. Again, it would make sense to have a Son of Man language inside of a kingdom parable, right? Kingdom of heaven is like Son of Man. So, the one who sows the good seed is the Son of Man. Verse 38, the field is the world. The field is the world. That's the second element. The field is the world. Which at this point, this is kind of describing Matthew chapter 1 and 2. For the Son of Man came to earth and now began to start to spread the seed out onto the earth. Verse 38, the field is the world, and the good seed stands for the sons of the kingdom. So we're not just dealing with chapters 1 and 2 of Matthew with this parable. We're also dealing with chapters 3 through 12. Why would I say that? Where do sons of the kingdom, also kind of pop up in previous Matthinian texts? Or at least the conceptual imagery of sons of the kingdom.
Beatitudes.
Absolutely. "For they will be called sons of God. For theirs is the kingdom of heaven." They are the heirs to this kingdom. See, he's not just grabbing in chapters 1 and 2, but he's also bringing in 3, 5 through 7. He's going to go all the way up through 12. Okay. The weeds, now we're going to be dealing with some of the imagery. The two key elements that come out in verse 25 are now coming out here in 38 and 39. Two key elements. The weeds are the sons of the evil one. So in the same way that the kingdom of God has sons of the kingdom, so also does the evil one have sons of his kingdom, heirs to the kingdom, ones that are fighting for his side of the battle. In verse 39, "And the enemy who sows them is the devil." Okay, so we get the picture now? We have the Son of Man that has come to earth, and the earth is the field, and he's spreading out his seed, and the seeds, that the good soil, the ones that end up growing, are the sons of the kingdom. The evil one, or Satan, comes, and he's spreading out his seed at the same time, though. And those are the sons of the kingdom of Satan. Moving on. The harvest is the end of the age. The end of the age, and the harvesters are angels. The end of the age word that is used there, remember we talked about before how the word end can be defined in multiple ways. When we were in chapter 10, the word for end that Jesus used was what? Anybody remember, Greek scholars? Tell us. What is the Greek word that he uses here? Suntaleia. Suntaleia. In the Gospel of Matthew, notice that caveat. In the Gospel of Matthew, these two words are used very specifically. Telos is always used to describe the end of a process, but not the absolute end of everything. Always. And I'll give you all the references for that. Telos is used in 10:22. It's used in Matthew 24:6, Matthew 24:13, Matthew 24:14. Once we get to Matthew 24, that will be very important, by the way. and in Matthew 26, 58. So telos is used in 10:22, 24:6, 24:13, 24:14, 26:58. And it is always describing the end of a process, but not the end of everything, not the consummation of all things. Soonteleia is used, and I'll give the references for this, in 13:39, 13:40, 13:49. Notice the concentration right here in chapter 13. 13:39, 13:40, 13:49, 24:3, which is the question that the disciples asked to Jesus before he talks about the destruction of the temple. And when will the end of the age come? Soonteleia. And 28:20, I will be with you even to the end of the age, the consummation of everything. Soonteleia is always used in the Gospel of Matthew. It is always used to refer to the end of everything. And that's the word we have here. Harvest at the end of the age. Are you following me? This one's talking, this is second coming. This is the end of a process, and it could be different processes. Like, for example, the process of Jesus being questioned in a trial. It's used in that way in Matthew. Okay? Right now you may be thinking, who cares? Later you will care. Okay? Because once we get to Matthew 24, this will be very important. Okay. But right now we'll just act like it means something. Fair? Harvesters are angels at the end. Okay? Verse 40. As the weeds are pulled up and burned in the fire, so it will be at the end of the age. So it will be at the end of the age. As the weeds are pulled up, the Son of Man will send out His angels, and they will weed out of His kingdom everything that causes sin and all who do evil. They will throw them into the fiery furnace where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Then the righteous will shine like the sun in the kingdom of their Father. He who has ears, let him hear. Be obedient. This is how the kingdom functions. This is the message, this is the description of the victory of the kingdom. That even in the face of evil, even whenever you look around and you look in all of our churches and there's loads of weeds that seem to be growing up everywhere, even in the face of evil, the kingdom will be victorious. It is not like what the Jews tell us. The Jews, or not the Jews of the old, ancient Jews, saying that in order for the kingdom to be established, all the evil must be eradicated. That is not true. This is why I still hold that the kingdom is reigning today, and I do think that Satan is bound, because even in the face of evil, I believe we will be victorious. I don't think we have to wait for all evil to be eradicated in order to say, now the kingdom is reigning. That doesn't seem to be what he's saying. He's saying, at the end of the age, we'll eradicate all of them. But until then, evil and good will be growing up next to each other. And I'm not going to uproot the evil, because if I did that, then I'd also be uprooting some good. It's just like whenever you have weed and weeds. Opposite of that. You following me? This is the message that he's bringing out. I will do this for I'll do that later. Okay. Verse 31. Yes. He told them another parable. The kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed, which a man took and planted in his field. Though it is the smallest of all your seeds. Notice he's not claiming it is the smallest of all seeds. Okay? I don't know why people try to ridiculously use something that's insignificant to prove that Jesus is wrong on something, but if they'd actually look at the words he's using, then they would realize it's not much of a contradiction at all. Though it is the smallest of all your seeds, yet when it grows, it is the largest of garden plants and becomes a tree, so that the birds of the air come and perch in its nest, or perch in its branches. He told them still another parable. The kingdom of heaven is like yeast that a woman took and mixed into a large amount of flour until it worked all through the dough. These two parables will come up later in the Gospel of Matthew. Jesus later will be talking in chapter 17, and he'll say, if you have faith like a mustard seed. Matter of fact, in just a chapter or so, he'll say, beware of the yeast of the Pharisees. So understanding how they function now will help us understand and interpret them later. How are they functioning now? They're functioning in the same way. They are describing the way in which the kingdom is establishing. The kingdom of heaven, the kingdom of heaven's establishment is not a moment. It is a process. It is not a moment. It is a process. To say when was the kingdom established? Was it established at Jesus' birth? Seems that way. Was it established in his ministry? Seems that way. Was it established in his cross and his resurrection and the destruction of the temple and the ascension in his second coming? Yes. Whoa. Knocked off my glasses. We're good. But yes, it's a process. It's a process. It's not a moment. It is being established. It is establishing. Does this make sense? It's like a mustard seed when it is planted. And the mustard seeds, my word, mustard seed, like those type of plants, they are vicious. I mean, they just spread and spread and spread. It's like a cancer that cannot be controlled. It is unbelievable what mustard seeds do. Same thing with yeast. When you put yeast in, the yeast is going to be spreading. And it is small and it is subtle and it doesn't look like much. It's pretty unbecoming. And yet the ultimate results of it are widespread. And this is what the kingdom is like. It doesn't look like much. But ultimately this, what doesn't look like much, is what spreads and spreads and spreads and cannot be controlled once it's on the move. That's what the kingdom, that's the program of the kingdom. Verse 34, Jesus spoke all these things to the crowds in parables. He did not say anything to them without using a parable. So was fulfilled what was spoken through the prophet. I will open my mouths in parables. I will utter things hidden since the creation of the world. Notice there we have the combination of secret and the combination of parables. And this comes from Psalm chapter 78, verse 2. Psalm 78, verse 2. Let me describe to you kind of the whole psalm. Okay? This is actually a pretty long psalm. It's got 64 verses. The first six verses are describing the establishment of Yahweh's covenant. First six verses, they describe the establishment of Yahweh's covenant. And in verse 7 and 8, it finally says this. It says, then they would put their trust in God and not forget His deeds. They want this covenant to be perpetuated generation to generation. They would not forget His deeds, but would keep His commands. Notice that. They would not be rebellious. They would not be like their forefathers, a stubborn and rebellious generation, whose hearts were not loyal to God, whose spirits were not faithful to Him. Verse 2 says, I speak with them in parables and reveal all the hidden things of creation. It's right in the context of what? People being rebellious against God's covenant. The same thing that we saw in the earlier explanation of why He speaks in parables. Then verses 9 through 16, He starts describing in the psalm, He starts describing the Exodus and all the amazing things that they saw and all the amazing things that they heard. And in verse 17, it says, but they continued to sin against Him, rebelling in the desert against the Most High. Even what they saw and even what they heard after these amazing things of the Exodus, they still rebelled. Doesn't that sound Matthean? Doesn't that sound like Matthew? What did we have that was tracing predominantly through the first half of Matthew? What motif? What theme? Exodus. The Exodus theme. And where Israel failed, Jesus succeeded. Even when the Exodus occurred at Israel, they still were rebelling against God. So the Psalm says, so all the Old Testament says. Psalm 78, 18 through 31 then goes to describe in ways in which Israel was rebelling, even though God kept showing His provision for them. It says, in spite of all this, they kept on sinning. In spite of His wonders, they did not believe. Their hearts were not loyal to Him. They were not faithful to His covenant. Psalm 78, verse 37 says. Then Psalm 78, 40 through 45 describes the plagues of the Exodus and God's provision to them by bringing them into the promised land. And then it ends again, Psalm 78, 56. But they put God to the test and rebelled against the Most High. They did not keep His statutes. So here at this point in the psalm, what is the psalm hammering on? Two things. First one is covenant. What is the second thing it's hammering on? Rebellion. Covenant, rebellion, covenant, rebellion, covenant, rebellion. And Jesus is saying, it's kind of like what's happening here. This new covenant is coming. And it's coming with words and with deeds that validates the authority of this kingdom to be established this way. And yet even though they see and hear this, they rebel. They rebel. It's kind of like Exodus, kind of like Moses. Then the psalm ends this way, in verse 57 through 64. It says, God abandons His people, and He lets them then devour themselves. But there is hope. For the psalm ends this way. I love this. This is so cool. The psalm ends in verse 65 and then 70 through 72. It says this. Then the Lord awoke as from sleep, as a man wakes from the stupor of wine. I think that's a funny metaphor for God. He awakes as if coming out of inebriation. Which, never mind. I was just going to say that with all the rebellion, he may have wanted to be drunk to forget all what they were doing. But anyway, he chose David, his servants, and took him from the sheep pens. Now listen to the way he describes David here. He took him from the sheep pens. From tending the sheep, he brought him to be the shepherd of his people, Jacob, of Israel, his inheritance. And David shepherded them with integrity of heart, with skillful hands he led them. It describes the humble circumstances from which David came. The very unbecoming ways in which the kingdom was first established. And yet it grew. David goes from sheep pens to being the shepherd of an entire kingdom. A kingdom in which he says, on David's throne, I will forever reign. Even though it looked very unbecoming, it ended up spreading to the point now where Jesus has come and he's going to be establishing it forever the way that was promised in Daniel 7. See, what he's doing is he's saying, man, my ministry so far in Matthew looks an awful lot like, it looks an awful lot like the whole Exodus and the history of Israel. We're covenant, rebellion, and yet there is hope. From an unbecoming manger all the way to a cross, we have victory. Why is he telling them in parables? Because they're rebellious. Okay, verse 44. We are going to get through this. We have 5 minutes. Hello. The kingdom of heaven is like treasure hidden in a field. When a man found it, he hid it again. And then in his joy went and sold all he had and bought that field. Again, verse 45, the kingdom of heaven is like. The word again tells me that he's going to be reiterating what he just said. The kingdom of heaven is like a merchant looking for fine pearls. When he found one of great value, he went away and sold everything he had and bought it. What's the point of these two parables? They're saying the same thing. What's the point? Help me. What's the point?
Pretty much give everything away for one thing.
Yeah, and what is the one thing?
Christ.
Yeah, the kingdom, Christ, what he's establishing. It is saying, this is how much the kingdom is worth. And as a result of its worth, this is how you should act. With absolute zeal, reckless abandon, to do whatever you can to secure and spread the kingdom. The worth is like a great pearl. For the worth is like a hidden treasure. And the two people, both of them, sell everything they had for this one thing. Why is it worth that much? Because of the victory. The victory that it promises. Let's hit the last parable. Once again, the kingdom of heaven is like a net that was let down into the lake and caught all kinds of fish. When it was full, the fishermen pulled it up on the shore. Then they sat down and collected the good fish in baskets, but threw the bad away. This is how it will be at the end of the age. Have we heard that language before? In this chapter. Yes, just three parables earlier. The explanation of the weeds and the wheat.
Does he use...
Suntalea. Same word. This is how it will be at the end of the age. The angels will come and separate the wicked from the righteous. Have we heard that before? Yes. The parable of the weeds and the wheat. And throw them into the fiery furnace where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Have we heard that before? Yes. What he is saying in the parable of the net is the same thing we've already heard in the parable of the weeds and the wheat. That whenever there will be a time whenever the crop is harvested. And that is the end of the age. But until then, the good and the bad will be side by side. They will be side by side. But in the face of evil, the kingdom of heaven will be victorious. Have you understood all these things? Verse 51, Jesus asked. Now at this point, my guess would be they would say, I still don't have a clue. Because they've consistently been confused at parables that seem like they're somewhat understandable. And yet their response changes. Yes, they replied. Very stark contrast to what we've seen so far. He said to them, therefore, every teacher of the law who has been instructed about the kingdom of heaven is like the owner of a house. Hold on, let's stop right there because there's a couple things we need to define. Let me see, where is it at? The phrase, who has been instructed. who has been instructed, is actually, I think, I agree with, I don't remember the guy's name now. I'll come up with the name tomorrow. Is actually better rendered who has been a disciple. Because it uses the word mathetes there. Who has been a disciple, who has been made a disciple, who has become a disciple. So that every teacher of the law who has become a disciple, and then I would honestly say this. No, I'm not going to say that. So who has become a disciple about the kingdom of heaven, who has been instructed about, who has become a disciple of the kingdom of heaven, is like the owner of a house who brings out his storeroom, new treasures as well as old. In other words, whenever you start to understand this kingdom, you will realize the connections to the kingdom of Israel from old. You'll get it. And what's really cool is whenever you lay them both out next to each other and they look an awful lot alike. The program should not shock us. I mean, David came from sheep pens. It should not shock us what's happening here with Jesus. They'll come out, and it's not like they're coming to brag. They're also coming to redistribute the wealth that they have, both old and new. 53. When Jesus had finished these parables, he moved on from there, coming to his hometown, which would be Nazareth. He began teaching the people in their synagogue. Whoops. And they were amazed. Where did this man get this wisdom and these miraculous powers? They asked. Isn't this the carpenter's son? Isn't his mother's name Mary? And aren't his brothers James, Joseph, Simon, and Judas? Aren't all his sisters with us? Where then did this man get all these things? And they took offense at him. Notice what we've just come off of. The parable of the sowers, the parable of the kingdom. How is it possible that this man who comes from Nazareth of all places can be describing victory of the kingdom of heaven? Is this real? I don't know if that's possible. As a matter of fact, they finally come full circle and they say, you know what? This actually kind of ticks me off. Who does this guy think he is? They have eyes to see, they have ears to hear, but they refuse to see or hear. Very stark contrast to what's happening with the disciples. You can even look at this and ask the question, what soil are they? And they took offense at him. But Jesus said to them, only in his hometown and in his own house is a prophet without honor. And he did not do any miracles there because of their lack of faith. How do we define faith? This is really important for application whenever you're in ministry. He didn't do any miracles there because of their lack of faith. See, if you would just love Jesus more, then God would heal you of your cancer. Is that what he's saying? Is that what this passage is saying? No, not at all. Their faith is the acknowledgement and the submission to the authority of Jesus. Which means, if he chooses to heal, I'm down. If he chooses not to heal, I'm good. Why? Because I submit to his authority. His plan is better and bigger than my comfort, period. And I pray with all that's in me, I'll be able to say that to my own deathbed, that his plan is more important than my comfort. It's more important than the longevity of my life. Because ultimately, a lot of times, I want God to abandon his plan so I can have an extra 5 years of living. Seems audacious. But listen, your healing is not based on how much you love Jesus. Your healing is based on his plan, and your submission to his authority is how you define your faith in that. As both a Lord and a Savior. Not just one or the other. Cool? Love you guys. See you in the morning.